The Conversation Hour with John Fain on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
I'm John Fain. Barry Humphries will be our guest in the Conversation Hour today and my co-host. I mean, when you've got Barry Humphries, you just call in the big guns, don't you? Richard Glover is the Drive presenter from 702 ABC Sydney. And Richard has just written a book about testicular cancer, about being a man's man, about hoisting planks by ropes tied to tow balls on cars instead of doing it the sensible way, all in the name of discovering his inner man, his man's man, whilst building a house in the country with some friends. Richard Glover's book is called The Mud House, Four Friends, One Block of Land and No Power Tools. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, John.
Is the house finished?
House is nearly finished after 25 years. I exaggerate slightly. There's one building we have entirely finished. It took us about 17 or 18 years. And then quite late in the process, my 14-year-old son said, I haven't really had a chance to be part of this building. He was mainly too young. And couldn't we build something else to so I can have a turn? And he immediately, as 14-year-olds do, started sketching designs in his head and on paper. And so we've, in the last 5 years, set out all over again and built a new place, which is kind of 80% finished. But look, if you're free next weekend, there's some more mud bricks to make.
Look, thanks. I'll just check. I might be rearranging my sock drawer. What's the urge? What's the compulsion?
Look, I think it started off, there's a couple of things, I suppose. It started off as one of those drunken conversations, which I think a lot of people have had, straight out of university, group of friends, why don't we buy a block of land and build a place ourselves? And mostly those conversations, by the next morning, everyone's sobered up and you give up the idea. In this case, we didn't, and we kept on talking about it, and it really dug its claws into us. For various reasons, I suppose. It was a chance to... We were all in love with the Aussie bush, which we still are. So it was a chance to do that. It was a chance to keep our friendship together. But I think for me, there was another level to it, which was I was if this doesn't sound too grand and too pretentious, I was very conflicted about my masculinity in a way that I think young Australian men now might not understand. But I went to high school in the late 70s, and what seemed to be the definition of Australian manhood wasn't that attractive to me, to a wan, bookish boy like me. It seemed to be a straitjacket more than a smorgasbord of great opportunities. I tell a story in the book just to show how sort of totally off my tree I was about my masculinity. I was in a theatre group, of course.
Of course.
Of course. You know, virtually a feminist theatre collective. So I had on one hand this kind of blokey masculinity of school, which I rejected, and on the other hand I had this sort of theatre club, which was all about, you know, we do endless plays about rape in war and things like that. And I remember this one moment where one of the girls said to me and another, you know, 17-year-old boy, can you two men move that rostrum? And we both reacted as if she'd slapped us in the face and called us rapists. The word man to our ears was so poisonous that you know, we just refused to move it until she called us guys or boys or something else or by our names. So that was where I was at, I suppose, as a man. Now, that's not a very healthy situation to be in, I don't think. And what the building gave me, and it took me a while to realise this, I suppose, but what the building gave me was a way of celebrating what could be called manly virtues, which is not to say that women don't have them, but a kind of determination and heavy lifting and persistence and a kind of blazing aggression when it comes to hammering in a nail. To the extent that you can call those manly virtues, I found a way of being a man that seemed positive and literally constructive and quite different, quite distant from those things that I had probably foolishly associated with masculinity.
The persistence that you have had to muster,
yes,
to see this through is a consistent thread right through it, as is your struggle with what it is to be a man, as is your struggle with technology, all of which are highly entertaining. But it's not,
yes, I should say it's a comedy book, really.
Yeah, it's not all plain sailing either.
No, and look, I think persistence is the right word. I'm on radio, I get offered all the time these books about climbing Everest and cycling across the Simpson Desert and peddling a canoe across the Tasman. And I never actually kind of, I suppose it's all right if people want to do that. But to me, the things that I really admire in others are are things that take a half a lifetime to achieve. I really admire the persistence of someone who keeps a small business going and employs people for 20 or 30 years. The persistence of somebody who goes through the good times and bad times of raising a family of kids. These sort of long-term achievements I find very admirable. And I suppose this is my version of that, a task which was attacked with no skill. There are no other virtues except for persistence. You know, we had no skill. We've got bad tempers. We've got dud smalls of the back. We've got nothing going for us except
no money.
Which meant in turn we had no power tools because we couldn't afford a generator. We'd spend all the money on this. You know, we start this when we're 24, so we're just out of university. We've got no money. All the money goes on the block, and that's partly why we. Go the Eltham way and do the mud bricks. But it also means we can't afford a generator. So every single plank in it. This is a list of how not to do it, by the way. Every single plank is sawn by hand. Every single bolt hole, brace and bit.
And then there's a funny time when you finally do get some power and you get a drill and you go, this is so easy. Yeah. Why don't we do this years ago?
$2,000. How much is it for a generator? It's like the Industrial Revolution finally arrives up our side of the mountain. A mere 250 years late.
A brush with testicular cancer?
No.
Must have been.
No.
Well, sorry, what
not
are you doing?
Really.
What are you doing having your manly bits fondled by a doctor
I think that's to overstate the tragedy. But
the subtext.
Well, there was just one amusing weekend, I think, when I had my British friends up there and we were invited by the neighbourhood farmer to help him cope with a bull that he wanted to knacker. And the timing of it was just at the time when I had, I think, a non-problematic lump on my
what
testicle.
Turned out to be.
But it just was funny that on the Friday, I'd been having my balls examined by the doctor. On the Saturday, I was sitting with Matthew Paris, London Times columnist, on the neck of a bull whilst it had its knackers removed. It was sedated. We needed to be sedated afterwards.
And the parallels are obviously...
Look, I think these are just part of the adventures of doing... I suppose overall I'd recommend people do this, despite all the tragedies and disasters of it. And part of the fun of it is, the sudden neighbourhood you find yourself in of strange neighbours and agricultural activities of which you've got no idea.
But it's a completely parallel universe. There you are, you're in your ABC job in the inner city and all the rest of it, and then suddenly you transport yourself to a completely different mindset. But longer term, the other thing that's remarkable is that you never fell out with the other couple. You and your wife never fell out with the other couple, which is what also happens to a lot of joint
ventures. I'm a very patient man. Now, everyone says that. Why didn't you fall out? But we didn't fall out, and I think one of the he does have a bit more technical skill than I do, my main partner in building, and one of the great pleasures of it recently has been to see Philip up on this roof structure of the new building teaching my now 17-year-old son how to use a saw in just the way that he taught me how to use it 25 years ago. And I find it very touching.
It is very touching. It's a good yarn, and it's of course the you've gone ahead and done what many others regard only ever as a fantasy, and so we can vicariously enjoy it.
And every single piece of what we did is good advice of what not to do.
Indeed, because you just might end up with a folly that's worth nothing on the market because no one else is ever interested in what you, of course, are very fond of. Congratulations both on the journey and the building as well as the book. Richard Glover, the Drive presenter from 702 ABC Sydney, has told us the story. It's called The Mud House. Four friends, one block of land, no power tools. Published, you may be surprised to know, by ABC Books through HarperCollins.
HarperCollins, actually. HarperCollins.
I didn't go through ABC
Harper,
Books.
Just HarperCollins.
Done at the corporation, did you?
Yeah.
Which has been so kind to you. That's interesting.
I know. It shows my bad dark side, doesn't it?
Richard Glover, The Mud House. Joining us, Barry Humphreys, who has finally told us the unauthorised and, I suspect, entirely fictitious account of how he has discovered...
Well, call the man a liar first up, John.
First up,
it's
straight
not
away.
Not a good beginning to this interview, John.
Welcome back to the conversation now, Barry Humphreys.
Thank you very much.
We now have this along with your other earlier accounts of Dame Edna.
Well, it may not tally altogether with Edna's account of events, but, I got a bit weary of being told that I was Dame Edna, and I like dressing up as this woman whose opinions on every subject are so divergent from my own. I've got nothing in common with the woman, But she wrote to me way back in the mid-50s, asking for my advice. I was a young actor myself. I'd had little more experience than she had. And I went along and saw her in a passion play in a church hall in Moonee Ponds. And she was terrible. But she had a certain electricity. What became known in the 70s as charisma. Remember, Bob Hawke was the only person to possess this great quality.
Paul Hogan.
Paul Hogan had charisma.
Yes.
Not many others.
No.
But I think Edna discovered it. And I knew there was a talent there somewhere, and I nurtured it, and I helped, and I put my own career, John, on hold.
Very generously, as you tell us.
I allowed myself to be marginalised by this woman. And there's the story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yes. Did you ever realise she would get so out of control, though?
No. No, I never saw that, Richard. It never struck me that I would be anything other than the dominant figure in this partnership. I didn't allow for it at all. We men don't sometimes with women. We marry not in my case or yours, but some of us marry people we think are just little mice, and they turn out to be monsters.
The relationship between Barry Humphries and Edna Everidge is like a marriage, then?
For a while it seemed to be that. I was everywhere with her, even, you know, during my several marriages, Edna was the dominant female figure.
Ah, like the Princess of Wales, there was a third person in the marriage.
A third person in the marriage, yes. I think that of course, Edna was a good friend of Princess Di.
Yes.
There's a picture of them together, as a matter of fact, in this book. There's a wealth of illustrations.
There is. In fact, that's one of the more compelling images of Princess Di almost staring, mesmerised.
Envious, I would have thought.
It's hard to know which was married, which one modelled herself on the other.
It is difficult, and the same with Margaret Thatcher, don't you think? Edna, of course, is advising. I mean, she's still there, sought by people. She's in Washington at the moment, helping Michelle Obama with her with matters of fashion and interior decoration.
Who else?
And she's giving elocution lessons to Julia Gillard. She's given that up.
There are some tasks that's too far.
I think that's the impossible task.
I don't think Julia Gillard should be put into that category, but moving right along, there's also some mention here, but not nearly enough information about the relationship between Edna Everidge and Celeste Patterson, for instance, and some of the other people who have been known to share billing from
time
to time.
Well, there is really no relationship between Edna and Celeste Patterson. She's always despised him, felt that he showed the world a completely false view of Australia and Australian men, and particularly he impugned the dignity of Australian politicians. Mind you, I always think Les Patterson is better dressed than most Australian politicians. Have you noticed that Turnbull is getting around in open neck shirts?
I saw that in the paper.
That's
today.
To make him a man of the people.
He was in shorts in the Sydney Press on
shorts,
Sunday.
Shorts, open neck shirts, not good.
Loafers.
Who's he thinking? Is Bob Hawke or something?
Yes, it's just an attempt, a rather pathetic attempt, I think.
Has Sir Les ever spoken publicly about Edna, or has Dame Edna ever spoken publicly
about
Sir Les?
He's always been respectful about Edna and gives her full credit, but Edna considers him to be a drunken slob, which of course is the truth, but
hard to argue with.
He survived. You see, he was sometimes on the same bill as Edna, so he'd be at the beginning of the show and she'd come on a bit later on. And she felt that a lot of her public, particularly very nice ladies, personifying the theme of the song you just played, niceness, would be deeply offended by Les, and they were.
Mm-hmm. You know? Well, when do you think her megalomania really got going, and what do you think caused it? Was it that simple first Pat 23 spotlight that she...
I think when the spot hit her and she heard the applause.
Monster. Instant monster?
Well, you see, it's a complicated matter, and I try to reflect this. I don't think, by the way, John and Richard, that I've succeeded by some of John's earlier comments, but I've tried to be fair. I've tried to be even-handed and show that in spite of all these really unattractive, unappetizing qualities, there's something she's got that is inimitable. and something that the public enjoy. And they feel somehow that behind it all is a sort of reluctant love. Perhaps I'm wrong.
It's very fair of you, of course, to try and look dispassionately over such a long relationship that you've had and to try to, now reflecting back, portray it for us, even some of the more intimate moments that you've had and the falling out, for instance, over the years. How much does the public need to know about the relationship between Barry Humphries and Edna?
As much as I've written. I don't think there'll be a volume two. But remember, Edna has...
Not if her lawyers have anything to do with it.
She's written her own story in a book called My Gorgeous Life. And I've written my own autobiography in two volumes. But this is not just a...
Do you think she might write a book about you?
No, I don't think she will. I think her daughter tried to do it.
Valmay.
Her daughter Valmay, who lives in Daylesford. I think Valmay did write a book, but Edna had it suppressed. It was going to be published by one of Rupert Murdoch's companies, and I think Edna called up Rupert because they're all friends. In fact, Rupert, as a schoolboy, used to deliver Edna's newspapers.
So it was a similar thing to the Hong Kong business, was it? You know,
a bit similar to that. So the book was suppressed and pulped.
Pulped as well.
And that did not help the relationship between mother and daughter. So, you know, it's an interesting story, I think, and there are some revelations here that I think will astound readers. What happened to Lois, the child, Edna's firstborn, who disappeared from her cot?
Which I'd never known about the tragedy that befell the family.
It was a tragedy. It was a precursor of the Lindy Chamberlain, Azaria Chamberlain story.
Yes, eerily so.
Eerily so.
Yeah.
In fact, Edna felt that it was a copycat crime.
Mm-hmm.
Except, of course, that a dingo was not involved, but a koala bear.
Hmm. They can be vicious.
They can be vicious. You would have encountered them building your house.
That's what the main use of the hard hat is, to stop them urinating on you from above.
Yes, and also they have very sharp claws. Mm-hmm. But this was a koala that had been terrorizing the neighborhood. It was feral. And Lois just vanished and was never discovered. Though the secret is unravelled in the last few pages of the book.
And those koalas have copped a lot of heat over the years.
They have.
And I don't want to spoil the book for those people who are going to themselves discover the exciting ending, which is there.
It is exciting. Did it take you by surprise, John?
Completely. And I was jumping up and down in my chair as I came to the exciting conclusion here.
I've tried, though, forgetting Edna's story, to write a little bit of a fragment of social history. The changes that have taken place in Australia. The conflict between Sydney and Melbourne.
No conflict.
The cultural conflict.
No. None of that.
If you can attribute culture to Sydney.
Yeah. It's the old oxymoron, isn't it? Yeah. But we also, I might say, find Barry that, well, it's either Barry Humphries or Edna Everidge, either one of them or maybe both are just insufferable name droppers. I mean, it is extraordinary, the journey through this book, of anybody, anywhere that Edna has ever encountered has to get a mention in this book.
Well, they do. I mean, they happened. If something happens, you refer to it.
Mm. Well, they would want it, too.
I think so.
They would be at the highest levels in Washington and London, flipping through the index of this book, hoping, praying for a mention.
That's why there isn't an index.
There is no index. I was frustrated.
They have to buy it.
Yes.
Whether it's Baroness Thatcher herself or...
Baroness Thatcher. Whoever. I don't think she's read the book, and I don't think she will.
Well, she's not well. I think we should leave
her.
Not a
well woman.
No. But I think, you know, from Elton John through to Lord Archer, Conrad Black. I mean, some of these people haven't even been to jail that get mentioned along the narrative.
There are people who are free and liberated people are also mentioned. Yes,
most of the cells so far have been to the prison service.
A truthful book, A Life of a Famous Woman, obviously requires a mention of some of her friends and acquaintances.
But we do get the feeling, I get the feeling as I read the book that, in fact, Dame Edna's relationship with some of these people might just be a tad superficial.
Might have been fleeting.
Yes.
I think it was.
Yes, right.
And I mean, Frank Sinatra, it was very fleeting.
Well, and for good reason, too, as
very
we learn.
Very good reason.
But it may be that, in fact, they're little more than a photo opportunity.
It's quite true. I make no apologies for the dame.
Hmm. Now, can I ask the Sydney question here, which is Moonee Ponds? Tell me about that. What does it mean?
It's a sacred site. Moonee Ponds is a suburb. You used to go through it on the way to the airport.
You've come around it on your way from the airport,
no,
Richard.
No, you come around it. So you look at a fence and taxi drivers say, Moonee Ponds over there, you know.
That's where Edna comes from, they'll say.
That's where Edna comes from. It was a Cinderella
Chimeresque street, yes.
And it's one of the few places in Australia, one of the very few place names that is half Aboriginal and half Anglo-Saxon.
So it is reconciliation in a place name?
It is reconciliation, yes, indeed, in a suburb, the name of a suburb. It was an old suburb, a neglected one, and really, I should say, I suppose, a working-class suburb.
Once.
Once. Not now. And Edna moved from the country. She was born in Wagga. Mm. And she moved, the family moved when she was very young to Moonee Ponds. And that's where I first saw her, in a church hall, in a passion play.
Have you been back to Moonee Ponds in recent times at all, Barry?
For a documentary crew.
For whom?
I think it was the BBC. Mm.
What did you find?
Very nice people. And many very old people who remembered her, who'd been to school with her. And that was extraordinary, really. Hmm. You can imagine how surprised I was.
Were they kind-hearted towards her, or did they feel that she'd left them behind?
They adored her, and they were very glad that she'd brought fame to Moonee Ponds. The house that they lived in is now a museum. You can not get into the street because of the buses of Japanese tourists.
It's like Graceland's, is it?
Well, it is.
Or like the neighbours tours, yes.
And like the neighbours tours. But
are there souvenir shops? And
oh, yes, there's a souvenir shop, and there are National Trust women in tartan skirts and twin sets sitting on stools watching eagerly.
Because I read the Qantas in-flight magazine thoroughly on the way down, and there was no mention of it.
Now, you see, that's the point. It's under-promoted, but it's nothing to do with me. They show films in what was the old garage. Norm's bedroom is there with his equipment.
But it's all there.
Her husband was, in fact, on a revolutionary Australian machine. By the way, do you snore, John?
I think most of us have to confess that at some point we do. Yes.
Well, a wonderful machine has been invented in Australia, mm-hmm. which, like a mask. Mm. Have you heard of this?
I have, and you look like an elephant in bed, but I
you
don't use,
do.
I don't
look
use
like
one
an
of
elephant.
Those. I don't.
It's been recommended to me, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. I can give you a better piece of advice.
What's that?
You can get, I don't want to advertise their product, but you can get a device like a mouth guard.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an upper mouth guard and a lower mouth guard
yes.
that you wear, and they have a little lug that then pushes your jaw forward and opens your air passageway, so you're not snoring.
Or you can stop necking a bottle of Shiraz every night, John.
Yeah, some people snore even if they don't neck a bottle of anything before they go to bed.
Well,
although you wouldn't know because you probably do it every night. You've never tried what it's like without it.
We are digressing. The point is that Norm had some equipment and meant with his problem prostate.
Yes.
And in those early days, of course, it was a very large mechanism. And they were considering buying the house next door and demolishing it so that it could be housed.
Yes.
And ducted in through the bedroom window.
Hmm.
And some of this equipment is still there and can be viewed.
It's rather a sort of Victorian image of our powerhouse museum, a sort of piece of large-scale industrial architecture.
Exactly. Exactly.
Rather than taking it down to the Science Museum, I think it should stay in situ. That's entirely proper.
It should.
A couple of things have always intrigued me, though, and Barry, as the lifelong manager for Dame Edna, I'm sure you can answer this for us. It took a long time for American audiences to warm to and appreciate what it is that Mrs. Everidge, Dame Edna, had to offer. What
well, I
that?
Think they were rather unsophisticated American.
No, that couldn't possibly be.
Well, it could possibly be. Everything's possible. But Edna first did an experimental show in New York in the late 70s, which was a dismal failure.
Mm-hmm.
The New York,
so you recount.
The New York Times, well, it's an honest book. You know. I mean, I'm not pretending it was a success when it wasn't.
Well, even all the tax rorts and the problems there, that's all...
It's all there.
Oh, I mean, I read this and I thought, no, I think this is just going too far.
Well, it's... I err on the side of honesty and directness, as you know.
Mm.
And Edna's show was called by the New York Times abysmal. Can you imagine that? Mm.
Can you imagine the rage she would have felt?
Well, she felt great rage. And yet...
Did she take it out on those closest
her
to her?
From to Studio 54 and having her portrait done by Andy Warhol.
See?
You see? Name dropping.
That's beautiful. It's so gently done, too.
So deftly done.
Oh!
Did she take? How did she react to that bad review? And did she take it out in an unfair fashion on her manager?
She blamed me. Oh,
of course, I thought she might have. Yeah.
How easy it is to pass the buck. So she went away, licked her wounds, and only reappeared in New York 25 years later. 25 years later.
And as her manager, did you ever wonder if that was in that period of time, if enough had changed in the American sensibility to reintroduce her? Or
I just felt that, well, it was Joan Rivers who helped there. Because I contacted...
Ding!
Another. Remember Joan?
Ding! Another name dot. Ding!
Ah. Well,
I should have been.
You've
surprised.
Heard of Joan Rivers. I think that was a name to drop.
She's been a guest on the conversation now, Joan Rivers.
Has she?
Yes, many years ago.
Well, she's good. Good
she's
news, Joan.
Fabulous.
And she's a very nice woman.
Yeah.
And you know, she's very old-fashioned and respectable.
In what way?
In every way.
What, sends you a card afterwards?
Oh, yes, all that.
I got that.
Yes.
Thank you for having me on your show. And you think, well, how extraordinary. Who else does she, I mean, where does she go? And she's got time to tick the box on those levels
she
of
does that.
Personal etiquette.
She's very, very good at that.
Not very American at all. It's almost like she
It's not.
American.
She's very courteous, very old-fashioned. Yep. But once she's on the stage, of course, she's a little more risque, a little wilder.
I've heard.
I called Joan and I said, look, we'd just done a show in London. That wasn't 100% successful either. And I said, look, what do we do next, Joan? And she said, go to America. She said, play in San Francisco. She said, you might get a very gay audience, but, I mean, what audience isn't? You know? I remember when the Opera House, Sydney Opera House, was being constructed, the great British composer Benjamin Britten was visiting Australia, and they talked, an Australian politician, as Les Paterson look-alike, took the great composer on a tour of the Opera House. And they said, what do you think of it, Sir Benjamin? And Benjamin said, well, it's very, very nice, it's going to be wonderful. He said, it's great that Australia, which has a comparatively small population, is sustaining an opera company and a magnificent opera house is being constructed. And the politician said, oh, look, Sir Benjamin, quite frankly, he said, if it wasn't for the Jews and the poofs, he said, Australian culture would be up shit creek.
Nothing's changed.
Very accurate rendition of that.
Nothing really has changed.
No.
But in all these disasters, did San Francisco.
Yeah, sorry. Briefly. Yeah, yeah.
On that point, there are some Jewish poofs around too. Imagine how good they're feeling about it all too.
I can't believe that.
That's true.
Single-handedly done.
Yeah, yeah. I could name names, but...
Please don't.
Their mothers don't know,
this
so I wouldn't.
This is a family show.
So San Francisco was a finally success, was it?
Yes, that was a great success. And then New York. And I feel that it's a lot to do with, it's not even the cultural climate or the country that you're in. It's confidence that makes comedy. If you go on feeling nervous and apprehensive, no good. It's effrontery, really. It's talent and effrontery.
But isn't, I mean, with great respect, Barry, isn't this where the manager has to bear some of the responsibility that Dame Edna was obviously feeling insecure? There was something you were doing that was making her feel insecure during those early performances in New York.
I think it probably was, you know. I can't say. I did allow Les Paterson to make an appearance, and I think that really
unnerved her.
And also, political correctness was just starting up. The Puritan movement, the old Plymouth Rock, the Plymouth Brethren, the founders, tall black hats were appearing in the audience.
So do you think Dame Edna on her own...
It's a
without
bugger to be seated behind.
Dame Edna without Sir Les may have got a different reception.
Who knows? Look,
it's ancient history now.
It's ancient history.
Speaking of ancient history, how much of the archival material from the early days exists? You've got Dame Edna with Graham Kennedy on in Melbourne Tonight.
Yes.
Does that still exist?
I think Channel 9 might still have some of that material. But
there's very little of
Graham
Kennedy.
We were not very good with the archives in Australia. We really didn't think it was important enough. I feel that if all those television commercials that we had in the early days of television had been preserved, what a picture of our culture that would have been. It's only a few of them that remain. The advertising agencies didn't keep stuff.
No.
I did a commercial just before I left England in 1959. And I did a commercial for something called Rice Chex, which was a breakfast cereal, of course. It wasn't long. I don't think rice checks survived on the breakfast table for very long in Melbourne or Australia. But I did an ad, a television ad for it, and I'd love to see that ad now.
Because?
I don't think it exists.
Norman Banks, is there any archival material of you, of Dame Edna appearing?
There must be.
With Norman Banks?
That was 3KZ, I think. There must be, but it would be by accident. A lot of stuff is preserved because listeners recorded things. There's been a wonderful CD issued of William Capel, a great pianist, American pianist who visited Australia, and he did some recordings in the Melbourne Town Hall, or rather broadcasts from the Melbourne Town Hall, which were not recorded by the ABC, but were recorded by an amateur at home, and now these tapes were discovered, remastered.
Yep, like the NASA moon landing.
Yeah, and there they are now on a wonderful CD, and William Capel's visit to Australia was condemned by the music critics, unfortunately, and he didn't get a very good critical reception here.
But the broadcast media is not very good at looking after its own material.
So what you're saying about amateurs for goodness sake, if you're listening today, go and have a route around your garage because you might find Dame Edna.
You could find some early Edna material that we don't know about. Mm. We hear that she was once a very nice person.
No.
Is that possible?
No. She's always been how she is. Leopards don't change their spots, do they?
Can I speak about the manager and put a point of confidence in the manager? Because he's been criticised, I think, in the last 20 minutes or so.
And very, very directly criticised.
When I was 19, I got a job in London working in one of those terrible little ticket booths which sell tickets to, you know, gaudily painted booths which sell tickets to tourists. And
ticks and things.
Yes, exactly. And I think double ticks was more. We used to charge a premium for our services. It was a somewhat shady enterprise, but it had power because when tourists came into town, they would come into these little gaudy booths, and it would often be the kids who worked there who would get to recommend the shows they went to. But we were always, no one realised the power we had until this show came into town of Dame Edna and, of course, her manager. And her manager, who was the first person who ever understood the importance of the gaudy booths, and he put on a cocktail party for all the young, 19 and 20-year-old kids who worked in these ticket booths in London.
And we went and we met
Dame Edna, free booze and chips and all that in the foyer of the theatre. The only person who ever did it. And as a result, for the next 2 months, every time someone came in and said, "Where do you think we should go tonight?" we would say, "The Dame Edna Show."
Oh, well, that's good, because I do consider those ticket booths, everyone who sells your tickets, very important. But some performers don't. They don't even believe in publicity. They don't like to do interviews. Luckily, I enjoy it. I mean, I'm promoting this book because it's my own.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say promoting, really, but...
Not on the ABC.
I think it's doomed, really, in a way, by Edna's lawyers. I think it'll be pulped.
But no. The prison sales have already been extensive.
Have they?
Oh, yes. They're flipping through it
it's a
prison library as we speak.
But the prison authorities would be pleased because there's nothing arousing in it, is there?
That's right.
Nothing that could cause restlessness.
It's literary bromide for the...
literary bromide.
For the incarcerated.
It is.
There's a brief mention in the business pages of some of the newspapers today about the Australian Tax Office issuing an assessment against one individual for $240 million, thereabouts. You recount in some fairly, not much detail, you briefly recount the problems that Dame Edna found herself in with the tax authorities.
She did.
Surely it's not history repeating here, Barry Humphreys. It's not Dame Edna again, is it?
No. No, I don't think it is Dame Edna. It was a name not given.
No.
No. I think Dame Edna has actually sorted all that out. But she was embezzled, you see, and she was a victim of an empire-building accountant.
And a crooked lawyer.
Now, it's a nasty combination, And they both had those white collars with blue shirts, that contrasting look.
Yes.
That they like.
I have one of those. I made sure I didn't wear it today.
And a striped tie that looks as though you're a member of some club or went to some school that you didn't go to.
Yeah.
Yeah, those shonky lawyers. But I suppose that's why Malcolm Turnbull is dressed so simply these days.
What effect did it have on Dame Edna to find that all her hard work...
Very unpleasant. She lost all her savings. Mm-hmm. And had really to start her career again.
And when you talk, as Richard just did, about how you need some inner confidence and presence in order to stump up on the stage and perform
in front
of... I think
it was I who said that, actually.
Yeah. Sorry, Barry.
In answer to his question, what effect does it then have on the performer to be labouring under those sorts of...
You have to labour under any circumstances. I, myself, have been on stage under difficult circumstances with quite worrying personal problems, and you have to put those aside.
Your multiple divorces.
Multiple. I mean, and it didn't all happen at once.
No. Sequential.
But I think any marital disturbance is distressing, yeah, if you have human feelings.
Right. You briefly recount to us how, and you said earlier just today, that you put your own personal theatrical career on hold in order to serve Dame Edna. What might Barry Humphreys' theatrical career have amounted to if Dame Edna had not taken over?
I think I might have been a notable Shakespearean actor.
or Rolf Harris.
Or Rolf Harris. Perhaps even Paul Hogan.
You have the painting skill and the theatrical skill.
Yes, I have. Luckily, I have a lot of other things, to use a period phrase, to fall back on. Mm-hmm. When I first started off in the theatre, my mother said, "Oh, you do really need something. Barry needs something to fall back on." It sounded so painful.
Yes.
So since then, it's extraordinary the power of our parents, isn't it? They still reach out of the past and influence us. We hear phrases of our parents. Do you find that, Richard, or not? Did you repudiate your background?
Well, no. I didn't write a lot about my parents in this book because I found the tale was so grim that it overwhelmed the rest of the material.
Really?
your mother gets quite a mention, your father only in passing.
Yes, he did. Well, you know, my mother seemed to me quite a relevant figure in telling this story because there was something about Edna that reminded me of my mother. Of course, my mother was a totally different woman, a totally different type of person, and yet sometimes my mother would use a phrase that sounded a bit like Edna, or the other way around.
That must have been quite creepy, freaky.
Very creepy. Very. But then readers have told me...
As if she was almost channeling your mother.
Indeed. As if Edna was actually channeling my mother, or your mother.
Mm. God, frightening.
Or everyone's
mother.
Or
perhaps both.
Or perhaps the mothers all over Australia.
Oh. Collective mothers. Mm. And yet... Your father doesn't seem to have had nearly as much influence on your business decisions, even though he was clearly a successful business figure. And here you are managing the career of one of the world's great superstars, and your father's business influence doesn't seem to have
come
through like your mother's.
No, but my father did have an influence on me, and I wish, in a way, that I'd had an opportunity to thank him more generously and emotionally for his contribution to my life subsequently. He was a builder of suburban houses, and I've always been interested, as a result, in the places people live in. And when I'm on stage, I look out at that audience and I think, you know, I wonder what they left behind, where they live in society. And Edna is much more direct. She asks them. Mm-hmm. She asks them to describe their houses. And what is strange is how few people can remember what their houses look like.
But parenting is a consistent thread. We are terribly different to our own children compared to how our parents were to us. And Edna, as an example of a generational transition also, I mean, she's obviously very different in her parenting, as was your parents to you, and you are...
Well, Edna believes
children.
In benevolent neglect. Not even benevolent, sometimes malevolent neglect.
Well, she says again and again, I put my career before my family.
Yes, she should put your children last because they'll never thank you if you devote your life to them.
I think they all did. I think that generation did do that, actually.
Yes, I think we're much closer. I mean, you, John, have gone on this wonderful six-month drive with your son. And... that's something your son will absolutely never forget.
Or forgive me for.
Or forgive you for. And your wife might come around to a form of forgiveness. But either way, that's important. And I'm much closer to my children than my parents were to me. It was considered just slightly indecent to be, to display affection, I suppose. Mm. My father never took me to a sporting event. Yet he bought me things. I mean, I have had a cricket bat that had been signed by Alan Kippax, mm-hmm. a forgotten but great cricketer. I had football boots, a football, all sorts of sporting accoutrements bought for me. But he never took me to a match, ever. And yet, where we lived in Camberwell, every Saturday afternoon, across a few rooftops, I heard the roar of a football crowd. And to me, it was the most repellent and horrible noise I'd ever heard. And so I don't go to sporting events.
But you didn't understand what was going on in there?
No, something very unpleasant was happening.
Well, my father was a member of the Sydney Cricket Ground or whatever, you know, which is quite a good thing to be. He was an enthusiastic spectator. Never took me. And so, similarly, I had an autograph book, which were very popular in the 60s, with all the Australian cricket team's signatures in it, which he'd gathered for me, but hadn't actually thought to take me with him.
Have you still got it?
I don't know. I'll have to search. It might be worth something, yes.
9 minutes to 12 on the Conversation Hour. Barry Humphries is our guest. Richard Glover from 702 ABC Sydney is my co-host.
The Mudhouse.
Yes.
Building a mudhouse in, where was it?
It's near Wombeyan Caves, which is near Mittagong, I suppose, halfway between Goulburn and Sydney.
I know Mittagong, yes. Wonderful.
I can't quite imagine Dame Edna relating to the construction by hand of a mud brick cottage in the hills.
I think she went, though, you know, years ago, to the suburb of Eltham. Mm. Then, of
she
course,
was, yes.
Montsalvat.
Mm. Montsalvat. Mm. She would go up there and she'd see the nudists, they were called. Mm-hmm. They were all fully dressed. And they had beards, but they were, in fact, described generally as nudists.
Now, I researched a lot. At the time when we were building the house, I researched Montsalvat. Because, you know, Munbrick was very popular in the 1880s and then again at Montsalvat in the 1930s. Mm. But when we were doing this in the 80s, it really wasn't popular and it was hard to find manuals. And I went back to Jurgensen, I think he's called at Montsalvat.
Yes, Jurgensen.
Sigmund's the son of...
Yes.
I discovered that he used Pliny. And because in Pliny's Natural Histories, he describes how to do it.
Does he?
And so we had a, this is in 1980-something, and we had a library copy of Pliny's Natural Histories, you know, volume 3 or something, and he described the process. And every time something went wrong, my co-builder would say, you don't think we should get a manual that's a bit more than 2,000, a little less than 2,000 years old, do you? Could that be why we keep on going wrong? But yeah, we built it using Pliny.
Wonderful.
And there goes, you see, mud brick, your credentials soaring in some circles, Richard Glover.
Because of the basis of the advice from Pliny. Not all the advice from Pliny was good.
No.
Your inner hippie coming out. But Barry, in this account of Dame Edna, I have to ask you about the identity of some of the hacks who have apparently been gunning for Dame Edna for a long time. I'll just read a little passage. Still a couple of hacks I might bump into who regularly wrote nasty articles in the Australian and the Sydney Morning Herald exposing me variously as a fraud, a middle-class snob, a fascist out of touch and not faintly funny. Indeed, to this day, who is it? There is a pompous old bore and ex-Zaverian who writes a political column in the Herald and periodically feels the need to squeeze his pustules in public on the subject of me and my undeserved popularity. Name names.
Gosh.
Oh, I can't remember who that was.
Not for a moment.
I mean, that description covers most people in Sydney.
It does. Squeezing their pustules in public.
In spasms of hate. That's our pastime.
No, what surprised me really was that this chap, whose name will come to me, this chap...
Shortly after we finish the broadcast.
Feels it necessary to write... Every time I come to Australia, he recycles the same piece.
Yeah.
And it's a puzzling thing, isn't it, really? I mean,
it's his own psychotherapy happening on the page.
It helps
paper.
Him. His shrink has probably told her to do it.
Yes.
Otherwise, he might become a mass murderer.
Dame Edna is doing well, taking the heat of his hatred.
Someone has to
do it. She can do it.
It's me this guy attacks, not her.
Barry Humphries, in his capacity as the manager. At what point, if ever, does Dame Edna decide that it's best to leave us with memories rather than more performances?
I think Edna will be giving many more performances. She's actually appearing on stage with me. Well, That will skittle your theory that we're the same person.
No, never mind.
With the Australian Chamber Orchestra in December.
14th to the 17th of December.
That's right.
Sydney and Melbourne booking through Ticketmaster. Barry Humphries, Dame Edna and Sir Les Paterson in concert with the Australian Chamber Orchestra. 14th to the 17th of December, Melbourne and Sydney. But at the same time, I mean, this is a reasonable question for us to ask because of the generation that Richard and I represent, people in their early 50s, we have grown up with the constant presence of Dame Edna.
Well, she's been more of a mother to us than our own mothers.
It's hard to imagine what it would be like without her guiding influence. Mm. So does she keep going forever?
I think she'll keep going until it becomes very obvious that she's had seen better days. At the moment, there's only been one worrying indication.
A slight tremor of the...
No tremor. Confident as ever.
Yes.
In a sense, you would agree with her gynaecologist and say she was at the height of her powers. But she came off stage quite recently in Los Angeles and she said, you know, they didn't seem to laugh. I told that story in Act Two and... It's quite a long story, and I told it exactly as I always tell it, and people didn't laugh very much. She said, "Why was that?" And I said, "Well, Edna, you told the same story in Act One."
It's sad, isn't it?
Isn't it sad?
But all great Australian icons go on just a little bit too long.
They do. Melba, perhaps. Melba.
Farnham.
Farnham. Oh no, we must not speak ill of Johnny.
Wash your mouth out.
Please.
Well, let me put it another way. They tend to retire and then come back. Retire and come back.
Yes.
There are many a farewell tour.
Too much of a
and
good
since
thing
she hasn't
not
done
enough.
Her, since she hasn't done her first farewell tour, surely there's at least two
She's
decades.
She's just done there. Her first farewell tour in the United States.
Oh, there you go.
First of many, I think it was subtitled. But the concerts will be very good with... Tognetti, and I'm going to be doing I'm going to be doing Facade.
As Barry Humphries.
Have you seen that? Ever heard it? Yes. It's by it's poems by Edith Sitwell, music by William Walton, and originally performed in the mid 1920s in England. It's still very modern. It's kind of it's like rap.
Mm. Barry Humphries, some lovely text messages for you. Barry, my aunt took you to your first day at Sunday school, Miss really? Virco.
Hmm. Good heavens.
That didn't have much of an impact.
Fancy that. Well, it did. And I'm a very nice person underneath it all.
Thank heavens for avant-garde. Love your work. Barry, you're a natural. Cutting-edge culture. You rock.
That's good.
Handling
see, the young like me.
That's it. See,
the
they
young
text. They've got the double
with
thumb.
Distrust and cynicism like you do.
Handling Edna, the unauthorised biography, Barry Humphries has spilled his guts, well, so to speak. Barry Humphries, thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you, John,
and Richard
very much.
Glover, Richard Glover, The Mudhouse Richard. Is the name of his book. This has been a special Conversation Hour on your ABC.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available every day. Log on to abc.net.au/Melbourne. Click the podcast link and subscribe now. You'll never know who you'll end up with on your player. abc.net.au/Melbourne.